Good morning. I have the enviable pleasure of following up Dr. George Nash. It is an honor and what I consider a genuine privilege speaking before you all today and with such a distinguished roster of panelists, including, if I may say, one of my intellectual mentors, Dr. Nash. But I'm also honored to be in the company of the indefatigable Dr. Arne, Henry Olson, and the Honorable James Buckley, whose career and family I've taught about for many years at American University, where I teach a course called History of the Conservative Movement. Yes, they actually let me teach that there. And I also want to say a special thank you to our executive director, Lenore Ely, for investing in our rising generational programming for younger members. It's been a dream of mine to contribute in a value-added manner to our society's timely yet timeless discussions. I hope you will indulge me as a history professor as I attempt to pick up where Al Regnery left off on Friday night with his discussion. As the saying goes, in order to know where we are, we must know where we've been. Al Regnery offered a brilliant overview of our movement, our ideas, and our role in the tradition of Western civilization, all the way to what had been at the time the culmination of the conservative movement, the presidency of Ronald Reagan. When thinking about the future of the conservative movement, like the Gipper, I tend to think of myself as a cheery optimist, but I will also offer a cautious warning about the future, about the battles not yet won, about the battles still ongoing that are necessary for any lasting conservative victory we may have achieved in the recent or distant past. Since this panel is titled, as George said, Toward a Post-Reagan Conservatism, with a question mark at the end of it, it is here where I'd like to begin with a brief history of the post-Reagan, post-Cold War period and its effect on the conservative movement, at least from a 34-year-old's perspective. And then I'd like to delve deeper into what I think is a major challenge that remains in the post-Reagan conservative movement, particularly, as George mentioned, dealing with the culture. You know, it's hard to believe that when Ronald Reagan left office on January 20th, 1989, that was 26 years ago, an entire generation. Think of it. The students who are in college today never lived during a Reagan or George H.W. Bush administration. This year, in 2015, my entering freshman in college would have been born in the year 1997. Which would mean that their first fleeting political memory might have been President Bill Clinton, and well, I'll let that thought simmer for a moment. Yet it is a testament to Reagan's lasting and powerful legacy that we are still here talking about him today. In the last couple of GOP presidential primaries, there was not a single GOP presidential candidate that did not invoke Reagan in one way or another. The post-Reagan, post-Cold War period has been a challenging yet reinvigorating time for conservatives. Yet much of it has been besieged by fracture as opposed to fusion. With the success of winning the Cold War and the fall of the Berlin Wall, anti-communism, the intellectual glue that held the three-legged stool conservative fusionist coalition together of libertarians and traditionalists began to dissipate. And recalcitrant divisions between the two groups started to become more visceral again. Though the conservative coalition, dismayed by the economic policies of George H.W. Bush, were reinvigorated by the historical elections of the 1994 Republican Revolution, according to Lee Edwards' book, The Conservative Revolution. This is the first time in 40 years both houses of Congress were controlled by Republicans. A renewed hope ensued. A fearless conservative leader was again at the helm, and early victories such as balancing the budget, welfare reform, and perceived peace and prosperity were at hand. In the late 1990s, though, this new enthusiasm began to putter. Fairly or unfairly, betting wrong on the government shutdowns. Fairly or unfairly, distracting itself with the president's impeachment proceedings. And fairly and unfairly, the perception of House Speaker Newt Gingrich overcompromising with the president. So much so, Gingrich barely averted an attempted coup from taking place from within the conservative ranks. At the time of President Clinton leaving office, believe this or not, he had an approval rating hovering around 70%, and his successor was waiting in the wings, most likely the next president, President Gore. I'll let that scary thought simmer for a moment as well. But when George W. Bush failed to win the popular vote in the 2000 presidential election, it cast a veneer of doubt that overshadowed the new fledgling administration. Never fully warming himself up to conservatives, conservatives were skeptical of what a second Bush administration cometh would bring. While good on tax cuts, conservatives were once again disappointed with the lack of financial restraint and expansion of the welfare state, with such legislation as No Child Left Behind and Medicare Part D. Then, September the 11th happened, and America woke up from what Charles Krauthammer has called a vacation from history, from 1989 to 2001. National security was again at the forefront, and things like No Child and Medicare Part D seemed tangential compared to the immediate task at hand, defeating Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan and then Iraq. It is during this time when the division within the conservative ranks really began to percolate to the surface. The Cold War anti-communists had fractured into two groups, isolationists or non-interventionists, those who believed in a Bob Taft-esque foreign policy and that we had gone too far in extending the war on terror to Iraq, and those who promoted a strong national security who believed America must exercise its muscle to defeat Al-Qaeda and the terrorist threat, even if it meant going into Iraq. Divisions also began to ferment among the libertarians and the social issue conservatives, in particular when it came to issues like marriage and the proper role of government. Libertarians' emphasis was on the economy and the individual, as it always has, while the social issue conservatives focused more on the culture and the family, like they've always had. While Bush was sympathetic to the social issue conservative community, he ran at the crosshairs of libertarians with his spending habits and the 2008 bailout. With no clear conservative leader, successor, and message going into the 2008 election, Americans took a chance on the guy who offered hope and change from the current state of affairs. And change is what he brought. But I allude not to the current administration's emphasis on when it comes to the quote-unquote transformational formation of America, but change in the ethos of the conservative movement. After the 2008 election, I'm sure you can all remember, it seemed the disparate conservative groups would never stop pointing fingers, blaming each other for the losses and the current state they found themselves in. But what happened next changed everything, and a new force was at play in response to Obama's stimulus package and government overreach. Dick Cheney once said that the greatest thing to ever happen to the modern conservative movement was Barack Obama. What manifested was an independent movement of constitutionally minded citizens speaking out at local congressional town hall meetings, rallying in the National Mall in Washington, D.C., and eventually forming Tea Party groups across the nation. Richard Viguerie once told me this was the most interesting thing to happen to the conservative movement since the 1994 Republican Revolution. Though succeeding in exciting the conservative base for the historical elections of 2010, they failed to coalesce around a single conservative candidate in 2012, and Mitt Romney was nominated and lost what many believed was a winnable election. After two defeats now at the presidential level, conservatives appeared to put some of their differences aside, united in their desire to win the 2014 elections and send a message to the Obama administration. While a powerful rebuke in 2010 and 2014, it still seems like it has not been enough to stem the flow of bad legislation, such as the Cromnibus Bill or the president's illegal amnesty decree. As 2016 approaches, I wonder, could the conservative division sprout up once again and be injurious to a potential conservative candidate who could take on the Republican establishment and provide a clear conservative alternative? Or do our divisions still divide us? You know, in the last couple of years, I've often wondered whether the problem with long-lasting conservative victory was endured due to the lack of philosophical fusion as a movement, or had we not been succeeding in the way we wanted to because we were not unified, or had been infighting with ourselves. Living in D.C., you have a front view seat of watching many of these disputes firsthand. Were we not capable of what Don Devine called yesterday a harmonious synthesis? Do the differences run too deep to fully ever be fused together? Do we need a new fusion or a refusion, or are we in a state of confusion? I was delighted yesterday during the fusion panel, really was, with the traditionalists and libertarians both being represented and Jacqueline Isaac's wonderful presentation about fusing the two, that fusion is certainly possible, and as Don Devine put it, a never-ending tension between liberty and tradition. And that's okay, as long as we keep the focus on the principles that'll keep us moving in the right direction. Conservatives are still successful at the polls, as we've won landslide congressional elections in 2010 and 2014. But why does it still not feel like enough? Perhaps it's also worth noting that we've only won the popular vote in the presidential election once in the last 27 years, 1988. I'll let that simmer for a moment, too. After 50, 60 years plus of a political movement in a post-Reagan world, have you ever thought, why are we still having to make the case to the American people about liberty and limited government? Even as we appear to be winning the political argument, for the moment anyway, we are losing on the cultural front. The next great battle for conservatives, I believe, is not the political sphere, but in the cultural one, as George mentioned. And when I say culture, I don't necessarily mean the social issue, culture-type issues. I'm talking about winning the hearts and minds of citizens, just as the liberals did in the 1960s, by slowly usurping our classrooms, the entertainment industry, and the administrative state. The long march towards the quote-unquote fundamental transformation of America didn't just happen overnight. This has been a long time coming, with planners on the left chipping away at our liberties over time. While we may be successful at the polls occasionally, it will not matter in the long run if we do not engage in the culture. And why should we do this? Quoting HarperCollins publisher Adam Bellow in a recent article, ideas and methods of the contemporary left, including its reactionary humorlessness, its bullying tone, and its impulse to dictate what people may and may not say. The left has always understood the importance of language to its transformational project. If you can control the use and even the meaning of words, as Orwell showed in 1984, or even Weaver described in Ideas of Consequences, they cannot be used to express dissenting views, or even to formulate the thoughts that might inform such intellectual resistance. And if you cannot actually dictate people's thoughts, you can force them into silence by making it too costly to express them. Some of you might find this contrary, as conservatives today now have Fox News. They dominate talk radio, have their own publishing imprints, and highly trafficked news websites. Yet, to be frank, a lot of this is catering to already convinced disciples of conservatism or conservative ideas. Some might even call it the echo chamber. The real problem here, and really what we must come to grips with, is that we may have reached the limit of what facts and reason arguments can do. Conservatives do seem to understand that this is a battle that must be engaged, but we don't seem to know how to fight it. What we urgently need to realize is that this is not a battle that can be fought in the realm of politics. We can win every election for the next 50 years, but it won't matter if we lose the culture. The late Andrew Breitbart once said that politics is downstream from culture, and he was right. Many times our side scoffs at Hollywood instead of engaging with it. Some might ask why this influence matters and why we should care about the culture. It matters because, for example, so I'm the new editor of the Conservative Book Club, I'm going to use a book example. The books Americans read can directly and indirectly influence their perception of current events and politics, and ultimately determine the direction of a nation. Even though we live in the age of 140 character tweets and Insta posts, the power of the word is just as influential today as it has been throughout human history. Consider the impact that books such as The Wealth of Nations, Brave New World, Conscious of a Conservative, Dreams from My Father, On the Origin of Species, and The Communist Manifesto have had in our society and culture since their publication. For the most part, average Americans do not get involved in politics simply through politics. They are typically inspired by a book they read, a song they heard, or a movie they watched. A prime example of this is the book-turned-movie American Sniper, and the national debate that has ensued about the nature of patriotism, the military, and America's involvement in the world. So what's the solution in conclusion? Quoting Adam Bellow again, for years conservatives have followed the rational left brain at the expense of the right. With due apologies to Russell Kirk, the conservative mind is unbalanced, hyperdeveloped in one respect and underdeveloped in another. We need to invest in the conservative right brain. We need to create programs and fellowships and think tanks that don't just deal with political issues, but identify, recruit, and provide funding and grants to those burgeoning students and writers, those seeking MFA or performance degrees programs, essentially those who want to participate in the cultural aspects of our society. We may not see their progress today or tomorrow, but in the long run, the investment will pay off. Currently, while many people in this room and many organizations contribute in some way to this, we really don't have a real infrastructure with this compared to the left, but we need to convince our donors. And this is a tough thing, not to give just to Karl Rove and campaigns, but to organizations that will be investing in the culture. And donors should hold these organizations accountable. I'm not saying we haven't done this, like I said, we have, but it's not enough. Imagine in the post-Reagan world we had done more to invest in the culture in the last 2 to 3 decades, after we did have our infrastructure in place at that time. Would an Obama have been elected? Maybe. Maybe not. Imagine investing in the future, teachers and artists who can inspire the next generation with more reverence to tradition and the founding principles. Imagine. In a post-Reagan world where I've outlined our recent history, the battles will not just be political but cultural. While it's been 34 years since the Gipper was elected, I submit we have much to do in this area, and I submit this idea for your consideration and discussion, and hope we can keep this conversation going even after this esteemed gathering. Thank you very much.